sacred places have many facets. Sometimes they are the place that we emerged from in the earth. Sometimes they are the place where we know that a certain medicine lives. Sometimes they are the place where the caribou birth their young, or the sturgeon spawn. Sacred places are like the spiritual recharge area.
Welcome to Sacred Land Speaks, where we dig into the audio archives of the Sacred Land Film Project and revisit the interview clips we left on the cutting room floor over 40 years of filmmaking. I'm your host, Toby McLeod. Today we bring you part one of a special interview with Anishinaabe activist, environmentalist, and writer, Winona LaDuke. I met Winona in 1980, when I went to hear Native American activist John Trudell speak in Oakland. I noticed that the young woman sitting in front of me was reading an article I had written about a uranium tailing spill in Church Rock, New Mexico. It was the first thing I'd ever published, so I was kind of excited about it. I tapped her on the shoulder and introduced myself, and she said, "Hi, I'm Winona. I was looking for you." That was the beginning of a lifelong friendship and decades of collaboration. We started as two young and not very objective journalists, covering the ravages of uranium and coal strip mining on Hopi and Navajo lands in the Southwest. At age 20, Winona was already the fiery speaker and brilliant thinker she still is today. Over a career spanning nearly 40 years of activism, Winona, an enrolled member of the Mississippi band Anishinaabe in Minnesota, has led movements for climate justice and indigenous rights. It's been a joy to follow her work over the years as she published 10 books, ran for vice president, led innovative grassroots environmental campaigns, and more recently fought and delayed the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline from the Alberta tar sands through northern Minnesota. In 2011, I interviewed Winona for our Standing on Sacred Ground film series. Throughout the four films, we interspersed the wisdom of visionary indigenous leaders and changemakers, people we affectionately called our big thinkers. We were only able to use a few minutes of the interviews, so today we bring you more of Winona's reflections on sacred land. Winona has long stood in solidarity with indigenous peoples around the world. At the beginning of the interview, I asked her to talk about the power rooted in sacred places and to share some of the common threads that weave together the different struggles indigenous peoples are fighting to protect sacred land all over Mother Earth.
I believe that power that we have as people doesn't come from us. It comes from the Creator and from our relatives and the sources of power that are there on the land. And so people are connected to that with depth, with reaffirming relationship intergenerationally at the same place, with having a ceremony or a sacrament or the food or the prayer or the song that always reaffirms that in this reciprocal relationship where you recognize the gift of power that is given to people and our ability to keep living. These Native peoples, Indigenous peoples who are fighting for their land everywhere they're fighting, they have that power because they have that relationship and they understand the significance of it. And they are very determined and committed to those places that they know the Spirit and the Creator gives them to reaffirm that relationship and are the sources of power. You know, we may not have all the guns, and we certainly don't have all the paper. You know, we don't have all the pens, we don't have all the courts, but we have that power. And that's what I see in these places that, you know, keeps people able to battle for so long against such hard odds, is that they have this with them. All peoples have origin stories and creation stories in which we're given a path and instructions and we often bumble around on it. But we usually find our way. There's divine intervention at many times in our people's histories. And in that divine intervention, there is often a place where we are instructed to go to find something, to clarify our path, to be healed, to know our direction, to get our food, to be instructed. And those are our sacred places. Sacred places have many facets. Sometimes they are the place that we emerged from in the earth. Sometimes they are the place where we know that a certain medicine lives. Sometimes they are the place where the caribou birth their young, or the sturgeon spawn. Sacred places are like the spiritual recharge area. Those are places of reverence and where we are always not only careful, but prayerful. In those places, we reaffirm our relationship to our relatives, to spiritual beings, and reaffirm our humility and our humbleness in our dependency on them all. We know those places if we remember who we are and we know our history. And we reaffirm that through our spiritual practice and through our day-to-day living and through being being people who have a good life. And what, you know, happens is the process of colonialism, whether it is the advent of the Christian churches, whether it is the military domination and destruction of peoples and places, whether it is developers, scientific paradigms, or naming, which is epidemic. The naming of places known as the heart of the mother, or the place where the thunder beings rest in their migration from west to east, naming them after, you know, small men who blast through for 40 years. There's this distancing which occurs, forcing indigenous peoples away from place, and a disconnect which exists between settler society and sacred space and sacred place. And as it is manifest in settler society, even by settlers who may not be attempting to be malicious, this separation continues. And so they don't know the connection. And so they come to place and they think, well, I put golf course on, it's not going to matter. You know, or what about multiple use of that sacred site? You can, you know, pray between the sixth and seventh hole, or maybe we just mine over here, or the military just takes that little place, or just a little bit of a oil in the place where life begins up there in the Gwich'in territory. That's the mentality. Everybody is colonized. Indigenous people have much closer connection, and people who settled, though, never learned, they never asked. They weren't allowed to ask, and they instead accepted the privilege of their settler society. And so they missed the consciousness that is associated with land.
Over the years, Winona and I have had many conversations about the role of Christianity in attacking Native spirituality, destroying culture, and taking land. I asked her to elaborate on the disconnect between settler society and sacred places. She spoke about how settler colonialism is predicated on separating indigenous people from their traditional homelands, and how in the background of all of the Indian wars throughout American history looms the Christian church at the root of indigenous land theft and erasure.
If you look at the etymology of the word colonization, it has the same root as the word colon. It means to digest. Colonization is the process of the digestion of one culture by another through military, economic, political, religious mechanisms. That is the process that you see historically. That's the process you see now. It is pervasive and it is insidious. Historically, it has been a companion to the taking of land and resources. And it is essential to separate people from their connection to their land. It works best if you can tell them that how they pray and their deepest connection spiritually needs to be supplanted by something that you offer them. The papal bulls of the 1490s argued and provided the political and religious arguments for colonialism that said basically if you were not Christian, you were not entitled to your land. and you should be vanquished and you should be destroyed. So that is the origins, is this sense of the righteousness of Christendom and the ownership of Christendom of the rest of the world. The government, in many cases, has worked well with new deployment of Christian churches into indigenous territories. In the teachings of these churches, there is a separation of the land that is there from the people. There is a cut of the umbilical cord so that people are not related to the land by the creation stories. They assume someone else's creation story. There is a loss of connection as to how we reaffirm relationship. Instead of having reaffirmation religions, we end up with commemorative religions that commemorate someone else's history someplace else. And then we end up with a belief that it doesn't matter what we do here because salvation is someplace else. And then it is easier to say your land can be treated poorly and mined because now you have a new life. And this is what evolution looks like, or this is what progress looks like. And so let them mine, let them damn. That must be God's will, because our salvation is in the next world. That whole set of religious teachings has very dangerous implications for indigenous communities and has been absolutely essential to the interests of mining corporations and governments in the religious and spiritual domination of peoples. And so you have a long process which has scarred people and land over these years in systematically attempting to replace our power with their Christian churches and then their government agents. They were able to destabilize many of our communities. And that they were pretty successful at for, you know, well over 100 years in many of our communities. We see the scars of that today, you know, whether it is at Hopi with the Mormon Church or the Catholic churches elsewhere, or the reality is that millions of people were killed in the name of the Catholic Church. And that practice continued for many years. And today continues in a different set of practices. But in all cases, it is essential to wedge a separation between people and their land. Despite all these attempts for all these years, people have retained, or they have recovered, you know, from the Christian colonial process and returned to the people that they originally were, because they find that their place in the creation is best discussed in those terms, spiritually. You have many people who have retained their songs and their ceremonies despite them being outlawed. You know, until 1978, with the passage of the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, as an example, I would assume that similar laws were passed internationally to outlaw our religious practices, because what the government knew is that power resides within our spiritual practice. And the communities that are facing neocolonialism or colonialism today, new forms of it, address it in different ways. There is, in some cases, a perception that we are surrounded. And our one choice is to become a part of this larger digestion process, because we cannot make it. And then we will hope for the best. And then there are some who resist, because what they have is worth more than what is offered. And they have a moment or an ability or a hope or a strategy that they are going to stick to. And sometimes you win. You know, you see people who retained connection and never forgot or somehow, as is in many of our prophecies, woke back up and remembered. And those people remain on these front lines.
Winona LaDuke is well known for her activism opposing oil pipelines, mining, and other environmentally destructive projects that threaten Indigenous peoples' homelands and sacred places. I've always marveled at the originality of her thinking, the surprises that always come from her analysis. Winona shared her thoughts about the lasting harm of those extractive projects and why she's fought against them with such determination for four decades.
Dams and pipelines and mines all cut to the core of who we are in relationship to our land by raping and destroying that which is most beautiful to us. And people fight to defend their land as families fight to defend women from rape and then yet watch it happen. The trauma of not only the action, but the 50 years that it will remain there remains as a deep scar on a people's psyche. There is the despair. There is the grief. There is the shame. I do not know how people recover. I think that people try to make amends, you know, with Creator. But the depth of the loss is very great. These corporations and these multitude of governments, on one level, one wants to tell them that what they're doing is so wrong in its spiritual terms, in terms of their own relationship to the world, to Mother Earth. And in terms of their denial of people's humanity. Another facet that I always want to say is your plan is bad. You cannot continue to build a society which is based on conquest. We have run out of places to conquer, places to put our flags, new places to mine, new places to dam. At a certain point, you have to bring your world into some sort of economy that is durable. And you need to do it sooner rather than later, because the more you compromise ecosystems and spiritual recharge areas, the harder it will be for us all, including you, to recover. I believe that people should not have to trade their ecosystem for running water, for electricity, and a clinic. In this millennium, when there is plenty of wealth in the world, where corporations, governments have the ability to provide those services as part of justice, they should be provided. The reality is that the U.S. spends more of its money on militarizing these countries than on any semblance of support for education or preventative health care or restorative agriculture. And the fact is that if you want peace, people have to be able to eat. And people have to be healthy.
One of the things I've learned from Native elders is that traditional knowledge comes from traditional foods. The way we think and remember as two-legged humans derives directly from what we take into our bodies. Pure water is, or should be, perhaps the primary element that nourishes us, giving life and feeding our minds and spirits. Sacred land, sacred food. And whether through wild rice or maple syrup, Winona has found her way back to the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe.
The Creator gave us all gifts. You know, water is one of the greatest healing gifts, and another is our foods. And those foods are given to us through instructions. And we Anishinaabe, in our prophecy, were instructed to go to the place where the food grows on the water. And that was wild rice. The Hawaiians, they refer to it as their cosmogenealogy. the fact that Kalo, or Taro, is their older brother and Kane is the younger brother. To many people, it is corn. In Ojibwe and Cree stories, we have clans that are related to the fish. We have Neme, sturgeon clan. Our spiritual practice and our constant prayers and our feasting, our fasting, and our return to sacred sites and honoring is essential to our ability to eat. We know that. So we always work hard in our communities to plant well and honor when we plant, pray when we plant. You know, pray when we harvest. Pray when we care for our plants. Because our ability to eat is entirely dependent upon our relationship with the Creator and our relationship to those foods. And so we are peoples that are related to these foods as spiritual beings, where there's a relationship that is worked out that is reciprocal and is based on our honoring that relationship. Your relatives could have wings or fins or roots or hands, paws. They're your relatives. They're part of creation, and we are related to them, and we are dependent on them. It's a very delicate balance that is reaffirmed through spiritual practice and reaffirmed through living well on land. Industrial society, mining companies, the tar sands, the military, disrupt that spiritual relationship in violating the place that our relatives live. I heard one of our elders refer to it as making paupers of our relatives, which is what industrial society does, is that humans have an entitlement to ecosystems. And we are above reproach. That worldview is directly in conflict with an indigenous worldview. The implications in our communities are devastating. The fact is, in most North American indigenous communities, as well as Aboriginal communities in Australia, the rapid forced transition from traditional food sources to industrialized food sources or commodities or government food sources or food bought at the bay, at northern stores, has caused diabetes and poverty. The reality is that people cannot afford the food in the northern stores and have understood that they could get food from land. Because that was the agreement, the covenant that people have always had with their relatives. So in many communities, you see the rise of these dietary-related illnesses. On my reservation, White Earth, and many other indigenous communities, you have a third of the people have diabetes. Entirely related to that forced transition from traditional foods to industrial foods. We cannot afford nice organic foods, cannot afford access to anything except for cheap foods. All of those full of sugar, all of those low in nutritional value. And so you take that mirror of that trauma that is caused by lack of access to foods and the sicknesses that come from it if they lose access to those foods. There's not a presumption of a safety net or a leeway. In my experience, or just in traditional Anishinaabe culture, the perception that you have a plan B is unrealistic. Take care of what you're supposed to do. Pray hard. Work hard. Take care that you have a lot of food for a contingency for a couple years, but don't assume there's going to be a Safeway. Don't assume there's a Whole Foods. Don't assume there's a shopping place.
The countries of Canada and Australia have offered official apologies for stealing children, not for stealing land. I asked Winona about the value of apologies and whether an apology from the U.S. government would have much meaning.
I believe that the United States does not actually have the political, emotional ability to show remorse. The reality is when the descendants of the survivors of the Wounded Knee Massacre in 1990 asked for a formal apology from U.S. Congress, asked that the 23 medals of honor that were given to the troops who killed the Indians would be stripped. Tom Daschle said, quote, "If we apologize to those Lakotas, we'll have to apologize to a lot of other people too." And so that whole question of having it have meaning, this, is an ongoing issue because there is a lack of any accountability for any behavior, which accentuates the denial of historic trauma, which exists in all of these Indigenous communities because the events and destruction and genocide which occurred is not acknowledged as having occurred. And so people suffer from the fact that what happened is invisible. And in this era, you have people who say, we want to help you, but they lack the depth of understanding of the trauma, of the problem, and become much more on the surface apologists. And we remain largely, I would argue, unable to fully heal. Because saying you're sorry has to mean something, and it has to change your behavior. That's what you would tell a five-year-old, is you can't kick your sister again. It has to mean something. Well, opening up a new mind after you say you're sorry is not changing your behavior. Running a bulldozer over a sacred site is not changing your behavior. Allowing egregious contamination into a community after apologizing is not changing your behavior. I think that as consciousness changes, as individuals who live and have grown accustomed to empire begin to question empire because of its deep psychological, spiritual, ecological, and economic implications, it is an opportunity to do the right thing and to begin that process of reconciliation. Because as, the South African experience taught us, the perpetrator and the victim are engaged in a relationship in which both lose some of their humanity. And so that process of recovering of humanity is an individual action that is then augmented or magnified, or whether it is policy or societal action. In recovering your humanity, you become a better person. And I believe you become a better society. Sometimes I say, what would Nelson do? Talking about Mandela, what would Mandela do? I mean, you look at the situation of, South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The president of Liberia, the first woman president of an African country, Ellen Johnson, she said, I believe in redemption. There's two sides. One side is the apology, in which the perpetrator says, what I did was wrong, and I would like to make amends to you. That has not happened. And the other side is the offer of redemption. Because as Mandela said, is that the perpetrator also carries this weight of the crime and becomes his own victim in that dynamic of having done something egregious. And so in that guilt, the perpetrator is not healthy either. So the process of apology and redemption or forgiveness, yeah, is a mutual healing process. I believe it takes many levels. The best story I know of that is the Pawnees were driven from their homeland in Nebraska. And with them, they took their sacred foods that they grew. Their pumpkins and their melons and their beans and their corn. And they moved to Oklahoma and they could not grow them. And their sacred seeds dwindled and dwindled until they had very few of some of those varieties. And then one day, a descendant of the settlers in the Pawnee homeland near Kearney, Nebraska, called the Pawnees and said, "We would like to grow your seeds. Would you let us?" And the Pawnees deliberated long because they had very few left. But they sent those seeds back to Nebraska. And the seeds flourished. And what the Pawnees told me was that the seeds remembered the land they came from. And in that, there was both an apology and a redemption. And 2 years ago, they had a Pawnee homecoming, Welcome Home Pawnee Days in Kearney, Nebraska, and 8,000 people came to welcome the Pawnees home. And so in that story, you have that corn is more than a food. It is a history. That seeds have spiritual meaning. And that corn in itself, though, needs relationship to humans. You have the loss of that sacred relationship. And the need in itself of those seeds for their land. And then you have people who make history through their redemption. Those people in Kearney, Nebraska, exemplify apology and redemption in action. I mean, it's the same thing as the Wintu story. When they get their salmon back, it'd be the same thing.
More than 100 years ago, fertilized salmon eggs were exported from the homeland of the Winnemem Wintu in Northern California to watersheds around the world. Those salmon survived in just one place, the South Island of New Zealand. And so another opportunity for redemption lies in the Winnemem struggle to bring wild salmon back from New Zealand and to restore their migratory route to the McLeod River, which was blocked when Shasta Dam was completed in the 1940s. Winona's been supporting Winnemem efforts to restore salmon to the McLeod River for decades, and her enthusiasm is based on personal experience bringing sturgeon back home.
To me, people have relationship to these relatives, and they lose their relatives, and they miss them. They're lonesome. And their relatives miss them. And it was of no fault of the people that they lost their relatives. But in this time, Indigenous people see and have the opportunity to recover. And so under laws like NAGPRA, our drums come back. Or our masks, or our regalia, or our, you know, sacred bundles to be danced or to be feasted. And we become healthier. And our relatives are renewed in their lives. Those beings that were cached away in museums, yeah? In my community, we lost our sturgeon. And my family went to Canada. And we found their relatives. and we brought back the first five to our lake on my reservation about 8 or 9 years ago. And now my tribe has one of the largest sturgeon restoration programs in the Great Lakes region. And the bay upon which I live, they call it Sturgeon Bay, because that is where the sturgeon in that lake go to, because that is where they were reborn in their place. In our community, our sturgeon clam had lost its relatives. And when those relatives returned, they felt more whole. And in our family, my first grandchild was sturgeon. And our family felt more whole in our relationship to place. My understanding of the Winnemem is based on that experience, perhaps, in that there's this grief and lonesome nature in a people who, for 1,000 years, have this songs for their fish, ceremonies for their fish, months that acknowledge those fish, and those fish are gone. And so they are singing and speaking to something that is not present. I hope that those people are reunited with their fish. And whether it is corn, or in our area, sturgeon, or whether it is these salmon, their return similarly brings this restoration of balance. And that makes things right. You know, I always like that Hawaiian word of pono. Makes things as they're supposed to be, righteous.
Winona shines a spotlight on the responsibility inherent in this righteousness. Within settler colonial society, it's a real challenge to live in right relationship with the land, to foster both humility and reciprocity. Winona also challenges the descendants of European settlers to learn how to be good allies in relationship to Native communities.
You know, in this generation, people want to restore some relationship to land. That is not only natural, that's good. In that restoration of relationship, which helps you become a better spiritual being, when you are grounded, it is important to be reverent and to know that not all places are for you or for me. That some ceremonies are from a certain people and a certain teaching, and those are theirs. But yet to pray at a place or on the edge of a place is still to pray. And that is a good thing. It is essential, though, that people be more enlightened. It is the responsibility of being from a settler society, trying to be conscious or enlightened in relationship to these places and these people. In that, you know, supporting people's resistance to encroachment or destruction is essential. You cannot just go and pray and take without helping that place be well. Because in the former of praying, it presumes both an entitlement and it misses the essential teaching of responsibility that goes with these sacred places and this land. We have great privilege. We are given everything here. But with that privilege, because we are human, we have free will. No other creatures have free will like we do. we have the responsibility to be righteous in our practice.
While industrial nation states still have a long way to go to improve the material and spiritual conditions for indigenous people, I find hope in what I've witnessed in the 40 years since I first met Winona, and she paints a powerful picture of the changes she's helped bring about in her Anishinaabe homeland.
This generation of Native people, many of them have been forced into urbanization, forced off their reservations, you know, raised far from their homelands. You know, I know that process myself because I was not raised in my community. I moved back when I got out of college 30 years ago. And in the course of my life, in my community, I've witnessed things return. When I moved back there, none of our drums were there. And now of the 13 drums, we have 7 back. We have a resurgence of language speakers. We have more people involved in our spiritual practice in the last 10 years than we had 40 years ago. We have more feasts, more ceremonies, more return to places like Manakawaning Nemis, the, you know, our Madeline Island, than there was for many years. As people shed the shadows, their fears, their shame of what has happened, and stand in the light. Who cannot be hopeful with that? That renaissance or recovery was prophesized, is very timely in terms of where we are in the crashing of ecosystems and industrial society and oil economies and large mining machines as they come to bear. You must be more conscious to protect, to reaffirm relationship. And in that reaffirming, though, and in that reconnecting and returning to whether it is the earth renewal ceremonies or Armadewan ceremonies, you see people who are revitalized in their spirit. So it is this synergy of people and place and ceremony that I feel around me that not only gives me hope, but also restores strength and stamina. Sacred places are like the spiritual recharge area. And that is where we are instructed to go to give our acknowledgments and thanksgivings. And in turn, we would, if we are righteous, receive the gifts we need for our work and for our lives. And so in this recovery of our humanity as Indigenous peoples, where we remember and we recover our things and we remember our songs and we rid ourselves of the cloaks of Christianity or the cloaks of consumerism and remember who we were supposed to be, these spiritual places not only buttress our beings, but are the places to which we must essentially go to keep restoring that relationship and recovering that power of place.
Ten years after our film interview with Winona, I had the chance to interview her on Zoom in 2020 at the start of the global COVID pandemic that had locked us all in our houses. I was grateful for Winona's upbeat perspective, helping to make sense of a scary time.
Our families are doing pretty good. We live out in the woods, you know, and so You know, I had a rigorous travel schedule plan where I was going to talk about a lot of important things. And then I just went home. And maple syruping season started, which is kind of like the Ojibwe New Year. So happy New Year. You know, we all went out in the woods and made medicine for a month. That's what I've been doing. You know, and interesting, I think everybody has this too, where time changes. Doesn't time change when you're in quarantine?
Yeah, what day is it today? I mean,
yeah, because when you're in maple syruping, it's only did the sap run or not? Because that's 5 hours worth of hauling, cooking, you know what I'm saying? So your day is the sap going to run or not? Right. And now it's planting time, you know, so it's a different land-based, localized way of life. And I think it's very healthy. You know, I mean, I'm quarantined with like 7 kids, of course, and 20 horses or something, but the kids' numbers goes up to 10, 15. You know, and we just hang out and do good stuff. So I think it's this, you know, so that's like, I'm really sorry about the sadness that this causes a lot of people. I also see, you know, for our place, it makes us be the people we're supposed to be. You know, in the bigger, more philosophical picture, I mean, Aaron Dottie Roy, you know, was talking about the pandemic as a portal. It was a really interesting thought because it's like it changed the world. It did. You know, and then what she said is like, so you're going to drag all that stuff from the last world into the next one? Or are you going to travel a little more light? And I like that. I like that we have this opportunity and this happy new year to figure out, you know, what it's like to consume 20% less fossil fuels. You know, what it's like to not count on food coming in from Tyson's because they aren't going to have no meat factories. You know, what it's like to relocalize. So I think it's a moment to do great things. And it really does usher in and requires kind of, I don't want to call it the green, well, we'll call it the Green New Deal, you know, but it requires this transformation. And, you know, I don't want to say, I don't think any Native person wants to say, I told you so. You know, but at some level, it's kind of like, we told you this for a long time. We got to quit doing dumb stuff.
Thanks to Winona's wise words over the years, many of us have at least tried to stop doing the dumb stuff. Let's keep it up. Tune into the next episode of Sacred Land Speaks for part two of my interview with Winona LaDuke, where she analyzes capitalism and our consumer economy's use of resources. If you like what you've heard, please rate and subscribe to Sacred Land Speaks on your favorite podcast app. You can also visit sacredland.org to learn more about our films, resources, and suggested actions you can take to protect sacred places. This episode was produced and written by Fiona McLeod, Callie Shanafelt-Wong, and Toby McLeod. Our interview with Winona LaDuke was recorded by Andy Black and Dave Wendlinger in collaboration with co-producer Jennifer Huang and writer Jessica Abbey. Our theme music was composed and performed by Stefan Smith and Charles Johnson. Sacred Land Speaks is brought to you by the Sacred Land Film Project of Earth Island Institute, based in the Lejon Ohlone territory of Hoochoon, otherwise known as Berkeley, California. Thanks for joining us.